Teague with it, perimeter right. Picks up the dribble, holds it head high, now gives it to George, right edge of the circle. One more time, played by Irving, right to the rim with a right-hand slam.
Hello and welcome into another playoff edition of the Sideline Guys podcast. Pat Boylan with Jeremiah Johnson. The Pacers are home from Cleveland, so is JJ. And get ready for games 3 and 4 back in Indianapolis. Two games, 1 and 2. Interested on your take. You were there as part of Fox Sports Indiana's postgame coverage. Two games that were fascinating in their own right because you look at both of them. Cleveland jumps out to great offensive starts. Then all of a sudden you're looking at the score at halftime and it's not too big of a deficit. Both games 1 and 2, Cleveland grows that lead in the late third, early fourth to where it seems maybe insurmountable. The Pacers come storming back, had a better opportunity in game one than they did in game two. But two games that felt a little bit similar, at least I thought, and the Pacers' defensive struggles probably being the biggest issue among them.
Yeah, obviously the defense is an issue, as I had Austin Crozier on the postgame show, and I started with, well, the Pacers are struggling, and I wanted to go defensively, but I didn't really know how to ask the question, and I could not even finish. I was like, duh, and he just took it from there, and it's obvious there are some issues, and I don't think what is obvious is how to fix those, because Cleveland is just a well-oiled machine, almost you could say like Golden State in terms of their offensive execution with the offensive weapons that they have. The Pacers, as many remember, gave up an 80-point first half to Golden State, and there was one point in basically both of the first halves when I had to remind myself that the Pacers had given up 80 in a first half, so this would not be the biggest point differential, or I should say most points given up in a first half against the team, because they gave up 80 to Golden State. But when you're watching Cleveland execute, and when they just continue to knock down shots, and you look up throughout games and you see 60% as a common occurrence what their in-game running field goal percentage is, you know there are things that need to be fixed. I know from watching practice, being at shoot-around, that they were discussing much of the practices and shoot-arounds were teaching points, and they had a lot of film study, and they are going over things that they would like to do defensively, but you almost can't stop everything when their guys are knocking down shots. And I think it's particularly troublesome when you're so worried about a guy like Kyle Korver in this series, and then someone that you may not be that worried with that hasn't really fit in until the playoffs. In my opinion, I haven't watched Cleveland extensively, but when a guy like Deron Williams comes in and hits 3 3-pointers in the first half, it's a little bit demoralizing, because I would say many times you would say, okay, as long as he's defended, and maybe he did get some of those as open looks that you do not want to give him that much space. But when he knocks down the three, I think it's troublesome. And it just continues to snowball from there. So defensively, I'm not sure what the Pacers are going to be able to do. Offensively, I don't know what Cleveland can do with the Pacers. So I think you might see games like we saw in games 1 and 2 the rest of this series. I do not expect the score to be in the 90s. I expect all of the games, both teams probably to be over 100. And what you'd have to hope is, whether it's Bankers Life Fieldhouse, being on the road, the Pacers trying some adjustment, you'd have to hope that Cleveland struggles just a little bit. I think in those two games, if Cleveland shoots 50% or less, maybe they are Pacer wins. And 54% in game one and 55% in game two. And Cleveland was sitting there at 60% at the end of the third quarter in both games. And that's going to be very difficult to beat a team like Cleveland anyways, let alone when they're shooting like that. So I didn't think the Pacers played badly or poorly in either one of those games. There were a number of sort of glaring mistakes or letdowns, and as Austin told me on the postgame show, the margin for error is extremely slim, and you cannot, you know, give them easy baskets or let them go on, you know, you expect maybe a 7-2 run, 9-2, but you can't let them go on longer runs than that. And the third quarter in game two, without, you know, what we saw mid to late third quarter, I think the Pacers could have been right there and won that game. But when you're down 18 to start the fourth, Cleveland probably let up just a little bit, and that helped the Pacers get back into the game. So a long-winded answer, but I had some random thoughts on what I saw in Cleveland. And, the Pacers need to fix some things, and it'll help they're back at home.
I want to make sure I'm wording this next statement and question carefully, and I'll ask you and get your take on it. Because LeBron James is, I think most people would agree, the best player in the world, and at very minimum, top two. I think for the most part, Paul George has neutralized his effect. Don't get me wrong, James has been fantastic, but so has George. 29 points for George in game number one, and you look at them both in game number two. George with 32, 8, and 7. LeBron with 25, 10, and 7. But James also had 8 turnovers in that game, and they both took 20 shots. So from that aspect, you go into a series like this, any series, you need your best player to be playing at his best. And I think it's undoubtedly that Paul George is doing that. And I think, you know, for the most part, it's coming close to, if not equalizing, the great work that LeBron James is doing. And if the Pacers can get that going forward, it seems to make this series, while still very difficult and somewhat daunting, down 2-0. If George can keep doing this and keep coming close, if not at or even above the level of LeBron James, then it's outplaying guys like Kyrie Irving, Kevin Love down the line. Very good players, all-star players. That seems a little bit more manageable to me, and I think one of the reasons why the Pacers have had a chance in both of these two games on the road against the defending champions as heavy underdogs is because George has played so well, and LeBron James hasn't been this monster while he has been offensively. And also fair to point out, George is guarding James on one end, and James isn't guarding George for the most part on the other end. I've been extremely impressed with what we've seen from Paul through two games.
Yeah, and that'd be my only concern would be, you know, he might wear down just a little bit, and that's a positive for the Pacers looking at games 3 and 4, 2 days between game 2 and 3, and then another 2 days between games 3 and 4, and Paul George has played pretty well in those circumstances over his career and during this season. And you referenced the defensive part, and that's something that I think gets lost a little bit, is basically Paul George is guarding LeBron James 90% of the time. They're switching at times, and everyone can remember some of those plays in game one when Jeff Teague was stuck on LeBron. But for the most part, LeBron is Paul's guy. LeBron is guarding Monte Ellis to start games, and he is kind of hiding out on what appears to me sometimes the fourth or fifth option. And I think that's by design, and he's a very good help defender, and he can, you know, give some room off of whoever he's guarding and then help his teammates. And it's a strategy I actually used to use at times in playing because I could see the floor a lot, and I felt like if I could not have to worry as much about the man I was guarding, I could provide help defense. And that's basically what LeBron is doing, and it's a blessing for Cleveland to be able to have that. But Cleveland is not defending well at all. Now, Paul George, I felt like in the second half of game two, started to wear down just a little bit in the third quarter, and that did contribute to the 33-20 Cleveland advantage in that period. But I think for the most part, Paul has pretty much, as you said, played LeBron pretty evenly, and the 8 turnovers, you can't just forget about that. I mean, because of Paul's defense, a big reason why LeBron James, someone who, as you said, viewed one of the top players in the world, can go into a game and commit 8 turnovers. So Paul is doing everything he can, and he has done so really since the All-Star break, especially March 1st. The numbers, the stats have been repeated quite a bit. I think we know that what we can expect from Paul George. He just needs a little bit more help from some of his teammates. He got more help from Jeff Teague in game two. Now just needs a little more. I'm looking for maybe even more minutes for a guy like CJ Miles to really come up with a big game like he had in that regular season game at Cleveland in early April. So we'll get into some other individual players, but you hit the nail on the head with Paul. I do not know how you could expect anything more from what we've seen from him.
All right, let's take a look at our Twitter questions. You sent out the tweet for questions, and actually we have gotten a good amount of, I think, quality questions. So let's bounce some of these back and forth. Two questions are coming from Pacers-Colts/Econ. The first of them talking about the starting lineup, asking if Nate McMillan might change things up, move Monte Ellis out. Now, in fairness, I think some people don't realize this because I think people tend to get a little bit too caught up in the five guys who start. And as Mark Monteith always points out, it's more important who you end the game with than who you start the game with. And in this specific question, they ask, might Monte Ellis go back to that sixth man kind of role, and could Stevenson go in? Well, last night in that game, game number two, Stevenson played 26 minutes and Ellis played 25 minutes. So Lance actually did play more minutes than Monte, and 26 is close to starters' minutes. That said, down 2-0, could you see the Pacers changing things up a little bit in their rotation, maybe not even if it's their starting five, especially when you include the fact that Glenn Robinson III is getting healthier by the day?
Glenn is kind of the person that I've got my eye on in this situation, because I think the role that Lance plays is right now perfectly suited for him. You've got his minutes a little bit under control. He had 26 minutes on in game two. In game one, he was the only reserve on either team over 20 minutes. So if you consider the starters for each team, he's basically the next player that's an extra starter between either the Pacers or the Cavs. Yeah, like as I said, no Cavs played 20 minutes. It was interesting that Shumpert came in after not having played in game one, 1 minute in the first half of game two, with J.R. Smith out with what they were calling a hamstring injury. But he's questioned that a little bit, saying he was fine to play and he was pouting. So that's something to keep an eye on. But Shumpert played nearly 20 minutes in the second half alone in game two. But I think the Pacers, that fifth starter, and that's kind of what I'm going to call Monte Ellis at this point, when you consider Paul, Miles, and Jeff, and then what Thaddeus brings you on both ends of the floor, the fifth starter needs to make sure to not overshadow guys like Paul George and Jeff Teague. So I think that Monte maybe has a few too many minutes, and in that third quarter, maybe you could have put in Lance Stephenson a little earlier. I don't think changing the starting lineup automatically fixes everything or changes everything, because if Lance has the ball a lot more and Paul doesn't, is that what you want? I think that Lance and Paul play together then in the fourth quarter, but you don't necessarily want all of their minutes to be on the floor together at the same time. So I'm not sure that you will see a starting lineup change. The only thing I could see in a playoff series, if Nate McMillan feels like it could provide a little bit of a jolt or just to mix things up, if that can help provide a little bit of a spark, much like this team got a little bit of a spark from Lance Stephenson when he signed, maybe it happens. So I'm kind of on the fence. I'm 50-50 on that. But I do think if Monte has, you know, it wasn't a great game for Monte. 1-for-4, you'd like to see him do more offensively. I don't know all of the defensive stats from him in that game in terms of, you know, the defensive rating and the individual numbers. But it would seem that, you know, it wasn't a great game for Monte, and you'd probably want to play Glenn a little more as he gets more comfortable, or maybe even Lance. So I don't know about a starting lineup change, but I do look for Glenn to continue to make a bigger impact, because he's someone I think that can help in the series.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think if anything, he's a bigger body in the backcourt, and I would expect him to start getting some more minutes. You know, Teague and Ellis are both really good NBA players, but they're sort of similar in that they're smaller, they're quicker, but they're kind of similar type of players. And I think perhaps you might see Robinson the III's minutes go up, Ellis is maybe a little bit down, and the rotation could stay the same. The other part of that I wanted to hit on, and look, Stephenson has started before, and the Pacers have been very good with Stephenson as a starter, so I don't mean to suggest that he shouldn't be in there, that he won't be in there, that he wouldn't excel in there, but I've seen a lot of this on Twitter. Why are the Pacers not starting Lance Stephenson? And maybe they will. As of taping this, there is no practice on Tuesday, so we haven't had a chance to talk with the coaches since you talked with them out in Cleveland after game number two. But I personally really like Lance Stephenson in the role that he's in, because as you said, he doesn't have to, you know, give off to Paul George. He doesn't have to relinquish his role to Teague or to Turner. He just gets to be him a lot more with the second unit. And at the end of the game, when you want your five best players in, if Lance is a group of that, then absolutely you have him in, and he has been in. But I really like Lance Stephenson for a lot of the game, kind of being switched off of that starting rotation, because I think he's able to do more. And I think in games one and two, Stephenson has been really strong. And I think part of that is because the role he has been in. And I think I would like him to stay in that. All right. Question. Same person. Pacers Colts Econ asks, why mainstream media seem bent on making it sound like PG hates his teammates? They're taking his quotes out of context. And this is something that I wanted to hit on, and I know you do too, because you're around this team almost constantly. I'm around them a lot. And I do feel like there has been a little bit of an unfair national take. And this is what happens in the playoffs. You know, national guys who cover all these teams and spend more time in Oakland, you know, and in Cleveland and not necessarily in Indianapolis, then they come and all of a sudden, you know, they've got these opinion articles on these games, and that's what they're paid to do. But I think the dynamic from each team is so different. And when I'm reading through, seeing some of these Paul George comments, you know, maybe he didn't word everything perfectly, but some of those things he's saying, you know, I don't view as outlandish. I don't think it's wrong or out there to say, you know, we need Lance to be better with his body language. We need as a team to do these things better. I almost think there's this national narrative that people, you know, see these words coming from George. They don't understand the locker room dynamic. And I think it's very different for every team. And as you know, this is mostly a laid-back group. And you know that George is having these conversations with these guys in the locker room. And I thought, I'm agreeing here with Pacers Colts Econ. I think this is a little bit too blown up. Your thoughts?
When you look at what happened at the end of Game 1, at the end of Game 2, if you win the game, it's mostly going to be praise. Although if you're Cleveland, maybe you win by one and people are still criticizing. When you lose, though, there is always going to be an excuse that is written about, or, you know, something negative about the game. And after Game 1, Paul George was visibly upset as he walked off the floor. Now, that was one of those situations where I was standing on the floor, basically almost in the tunnel, as I saw that shot from CJ miss. I did not even see Paul's reaction as much as everyone at home did, because no surprise, the cameras are on Paul at all times. And when that shot missed, you saw him express some frustration. He would not be human. He would not be the competitor that you want him to be if he wasn't frustrated. Now, you could argue that he should not have maybe gone to CJ right there on the floor and then subsequently said what he said after the game. So after Game 1, I wasn't real pleased with what Paul said. At the same time, I gave him a little bit of a pass because I know how he pretty much wears his emotions on his sleeves, and he answers every question. And if he believed that he should take the shot, he's not going to be one to say, no, I shouldn't take the shot. At the same time, at the end of Game 2, the reaction to what he said about Lance and Miles is comical, that he is calling out his teammates. If Miles or Lance do not feel as though they're being called out, then who is it for some reporter that's seen the Pacers play twice all year to right. say that he was calling them out? And I talked to both Miles and I talked to Lance. And granted, when I talked to them, it was prior to Paul George's press conference. However, if you listen to the question to Paul, when he's asked specifically about an individual player, he's probably going to answer the question. And would anyone watching that game not think the Pacers need more from Miles Turner, or think that Lance maybe could keep his emotions in check just a little bit? I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, that's what I saw. Now, I don't think that it's a reason the Pacers lost the game, especially the Lance one. I think more importantly was the defense on Kevin Love and how that, you know, 10-0 spurt, or the Kevin Love-Lance matchup, which Lance also admitted that he took responsibility for. That was as much of an issue than maybe Lance's emotions, because emotional Lance is kind of what got this team into the playoffs. So if you're asked a specific question, and if someone like Paul George is trying to maybe just a little bit challenge Miles Turner as he's done throughout his career, I don't see how it's all of a sudden him wanting to push his way out of town and alienate all of his teammates, and he's so unhappy here. It's been a frustrating season. Paul has wanted more from this season. Fans have wanted more from this season. But it's absolutely ridiculous, and it's just part of the culture that we are in right now, where there were only two games last night. I thought the national narrative today would have been about David Fizdale and his comments on the officiating, and it seems like it's turned into an even split of Paul George is a bad teammate, Paul George wants to leave town, and David Fizdale also is a sore loser. Now, that's pretty much the two storylines that are out there right now, although Fizdale's getting some credit. But I think it's crazy to think that because of those comments that people are jumping to the conclusions that they're jumping to. If Paul George goes out and wins the Pacers Game 3, then what is everyone going to say? He loves Indianapolis? I think that Paul has shown on more than one occasion, on numerous occasions, and his actions are speaking louder than even his words, and he says a lot with his words, that he wants to win a championship and he wants to do it in Indianapolis. Do the Pacers need to get a little extra help around him to get to that point? Obviously. Does Paul George dislike his teammates? I think that's crazy to jump to that conclusion as well. So, you know, it's a little frustrating to read all of these things. I chimed in a little bit on Twitter today, and I probably should back off just a little bit at this point. But the criticism of Paul, it's just part of being the superstar. So I would hope, and I don't know how he feels about some of these things. I think he does read what's on Twitter and social media, maybe even Instagram more than Twitter. I don't really know what his social media habits are, but I'm guessing at this point in his career, he's learned to block some of that out a little bit. And, you know, maybe if he wants to use some of it as fuel to the fire. But I don't know the reason why it seems like people want to go after him. I just think that maybe they're not used to someone maybe being so honest as Paul.
No, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there, and it's you know, a little funny because as this morning is taking place and you're seeing the pundits on the talk shows and on Twitter making all these comments, and I'm thinking, man, I didn't really see, you know, not to say that everything Paul has done is perfect or that he's, you know, a perfect player, but man, the guy's averaging over 30 per game in the two games. None of his comments seem to be unreasonable to me, and then all of a sudden there's this national backlash, and it was a little bit comforting. You know, we admittedly come at this from a biased perspective. We try to remove as many of those as possible, but it's impossible to be 100% neutral in our jobs, and I personally enjoyed seeing the Gradys, the Matt Glinesks, the Zach Kiefers of the world make comments like, whoa, where is this national storyline coming from? I've not seen anything like that. I've not experienced anything like that. I didn't take these comments like that. And that was kind of reassuring to me to know, okay, I'm not the only one here who thinks that maybe we're jumping from like a 4 to a 9 and missing some numbers in between here. But that I guess is part of what comes with the playoffs and with the increased attention.
And can you imagine if CJ does hit that shot, or maybe Paul beats the double team and attacks the basket and scores at the end of game one? I mean, none of this would be happening. And so is one field goal worth an entire storyline? I mean, it's what we do in sports. If a field goal in a football game at the final horn goes in and one team wins and one team loses, one team's great and the other's awful, or a coach gets fired. So I totally understand it's a win or lose business, and if you lose, you have to pay the consequences. But it is crazy to step back and look at that. And, you know, not having had a chance to really talk with you after game one, it was a little bit shocking to me, as I did some of the interviews immediately after the game. I thought of all these things that I thought were important, and similar to what you have to do after games, in that, you know, what are the two or three topics you want to get to? What is a question that you need to ask a certain player if you get him in the locker room? And I guess that last shot that CJ shot, it didn't seem as big to me in the 5 minutes after the game as it did 30 minutes later. And that was all anybody talked about for 24 to 48 hours. So I felt like I maybe did something wrong, but as I watched that whole game and saw it all unfold, I didn't think, man, shame on CJ, it's his fault, you know, or shame on him for not passing back to Paul. So everyone can view things differently, but I guess to sum up this topic, it would be, it's okay to have a different opinion than the four or five people that have a number of huge followings, and maybe they get their followings by saying things that are a little more outlandish or eccentric than others.
I think we all look for a culprit, especially in big games, for why this happened or why it didn't happen. But to close on this whole topic, you know, if you go into game number one and you say you're going to play well enough to have the final shot of the game, and if that shot goes in, you beat the defending champions in game number one of the playoffs, you take that without blinking. And then if you separately say, by the way, that shot is going to be CJ Miles, maybe your best shooter, and a little bit rushed and a little bit guarded, but a pretty darn good look, like a 6 or a 7 on a scale of 10 being a great look and one being have three defenders all over you, a pretty good look. I think individually you take those two things. Sometimes the play can work, the ball can have gone to the right person, he can take the right shot. You know, it's basketball. Sometimes a shot just doesn't go in, and that doesn't mean we have to go chasing down culprits. It can just be a shot that CJ hits 6 times out of 10. This was one of the four. At least that's how I feel on game number one. All right, let's move to our pick three, and I'll let you introduce it here. And we did have one more question, and we are going to answer it in this pick three. It was from Ross Blauvelt. I apologize if I'm saying that wrong, by the way. We are not in the business of promoting other podcasts, but if you have extra time after listening to ours, this is one of the members of the Corner 3 podcast, so feel free to give those guys a listen as well. But why don't you introduce here the pick three, and then I'll explain where Ross's question comes into play.
Sounds good. So for game three, Thursday night, Bankers Life Fieldhouse, it will be a gold out. And before game two, Paul George was asked if game two was a must win. And I think at times that can be a little bit of a tiresome question. I think in game two, it was not a must win, quote unquote, because if you go win two home games, then the series is all tied at two. But in this situation, if you want to win the series, I'd say you probably have to win game three. I cannot imagine the Pacers being down 0-3 and doing anything. So with a game this important, with this pick three, the question would be, Pat, what are three things the Pacers need to do to get a win? It's a simple question with our weekly or whenever we have a show, we always have a pick three topic, and we thought this could get us into our game three preview. And so normally I pick one topic or one answer, you pick another, and then there's a team answer. Let's start with the team answer. I think that we can almost in unison say 1, 2, 3 and say the same thing, but it's improve the defense.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a simple answer, and I'm not sure that there's a way to, you know, clearly for two sideline guys to be able to say, oh, all you have to do is do this and you'll improve the defense. But anything you see that stands out?
Well, that was Ross's question about improving the defense. And, you know, Nate McMillan and most coaches feel this way. They don't like switching on the defensive end because it creates mismatches. However, you know, in the NBA climate where, and let's be honest, Jeff Teague benefits from this as much as almost anyone, save James Harden and Lou Williams. You try to go over that screen with a good three-point shooter like Irving, and it's easy to get a foul. You go under that screen, and you get caught up for a half second, and Irving is so quick that he is by you. So a natural way to try to combat that is by switching on the defensive end. The guy who is on the screener then takes the point guard. The problem with that is if it's James setting a pick for Irving, then your switch moves James' man onto Irving and Irving's man onto James. Well, then you've got Jeff Teague on LeBron James. Hence the reason the Pacers don't like switching. But they're obviously to me, and I of course don't have this answer, and I totally agree with you, we would not be sideline guys if we had this answer. But obviously I think it focuses around the pick and roll defense. And maybe that is, you know, trying different lineups out there. Maybe it's going a little bit bigger and trying to combat some of their speed with size. Maybe it's trying guys like Glenn Robinson III a little bit more and trying rotations like that. Maybe on the defensive end, you know, if Teague is struggling with Irving, which by the way, Irving is also struggling with Teague, at least especially in game number two. But, you know, maybe would you ever try something where you put Lance on Irving and try to hide, you know, Teague on J.R. Smith or a Shumpert and then keep Paul on LeBron? I think maybe it just comes with a little bit of experimenting with the screen and rolls and maybe some matchups. And, you know, while Teague has never been thought of as a shutdown defender, I think for the most part of the season he's been adequate. It's just Kyrie Irving is so quick. And we've seen it on the other end. Teague beat Irving plenty of times, especially on game two as well. But I think the answer here comes in some form of pick and roll defense. And the good news for Indiana is, you know, while they did have one off day between games one and two, they've got two off days now to try to figure this out. Playing at home hopefully will aid in that a little bit. And, you know, Dan Burke has been doing defense for a long time. And I'm fairly confident the Pacers at least have some adjustments here to improve in that area.
I think the thing you have to be a little bit careful of is throwing in too many wrinkles and too many rules defensively, and you have guys out there thinking instead of reacting. And that's one of the things that I think that has helped Cleveland, especially in the second half of game two, in that third quarter when the Pacers had just 20 points in the third quarter. Shumpert provided a lot of additional pressure, I thought, on Paul George that even J.R. Smith and even LeBron, when LeBron was guarding Paul, that they were not providing. And that extra pressure just made things difficult, and it got the offense just a little bit discombobulated. We know about the double team that we saw at the end of game one when Paul George was double teamed. We saw more of that in the second half on just regular plays, not in critical game situations where they tried to force the ball out of Paul's hand. We saw that a lot this season with the Milwaukee Bucks when they tried to double team Paul. So what I guess my thought might be, and it's difficult when you've got shooters on the floor in the corners as good as Cleveland has, is maybe a few more double teams on these pick and rolls. If for no other reason, in order to double team, in order to play that way, you're guaranteeing that you've got to be aggressive. And, you know, I probably get as tired as anyone when hearing about a plan before a game or hearing an excuse or an acknowledgement after the game that the effort wasn't good enough, the sense of urgency wasn't good enough, or the intensity wasn't good enough. Because I think that's I actually think it's kind of selling out the players just a little bit, because I think they play pretty hard for the most part. And the more you say someone's not giving enough effort, I'm not sure that it's entirely fair to the players. But maybe if you just throw out some additional random double teams at times the Cavs aren't expecting, you can get them flustered a little bit. LeBron is fully capable of throwing it away, as evidenced by his 8 turnovers. And Kyrie Irving, he had 4 turnovers. So maybe do that a little bit more, but then you've got to be able to get back after that pass and help and cover and figure out where to go and then who to block out. So not saying that's going to fix everything, but maybe just increasing that defensive pressure, throwing some double teams so everyone has to just get out. Push the Cavaliers out beyond the 3-point arc. Get it to where, you know, the big thing is keeping them out of the paint. And I'm not sure that that's been as much of an issue in this series, is getting them getting to the paint, but they're just getting open looks. And so you probably are going to give up more open looks by running all over and double teaming and doing different things. But anything that can guarantee that you've just are ratcheting up the pressure and the intensity just a little bit, and go along with that, I think you've just got to play Glenn more. I think Glenn's someone who's capable, that can get out there and defend more. I think you play Lance about where you've got him. CJ Miles is a question mark, because he does struggle a little bit defensively on certain players. But you don't want to get in any more mismatch situations where you've got Kevin Love with Lance Stephenson guarding him on the post. They're going to find the mismatches. So I don't have a great answer, but I just think forcing Cleveland to start its offense further and further away from the basket is probably going to be as good as you can do, and hope for the best.
All right, so that was a pretty concrete nuts and bolts pick.
I'm sure, and by the way, I'm sure if someone like Dan Burke or someone who is a defensive specialist listened to what we say, they might just never listen to our podcast again, because we maybe said a bunch of things without actually saying something, but I'm not sure that we're in the position to sit there and rattle off this specific defensive strategy and say, oh, this will surely work. If it was so easy, it would have been done by now. But in summary, get your best defenders on the floor, get them in the best situation possible, and then block out.
And Cleveland's having this same discussion too. I mean, they were bad defensively from the All-Star break on, and in games 1 and 2, they're giving up about 110 points per game. So while the Pacers, you know, would like to see their defense improved, the Cavaliers are not playing at a current defensive rate that they can win a championship with. And so I think both teams are trying to figure this out right now. My pick number 2 and my personal pick is going to be off the court. It's going to be the crowd. It's going to be the energy. It's going to be the environment in Bankers Life Fieldhouse in game number 3. There's a lot of excitement surrounding this game. That's evidenced by, you know, how well tickets are selling. There are still some tickets available, but very, very few. If you go to pacers.com/tickets, you can be there. If you have a ticket, you have to be ready to bring it, okay? That Cleveland environment, I'm sure, was really, really loud. And the pace, I would probably need 4 or 5 hands to count the amount of times I've heard Paul George, Jeff Teague, someone along those lines say, we really feed off of this home crowd. And of course, that's true of everybody. That's not unique of the Pacers. But what is unique of the Pacers is just how good they were at home. And then they struggled on the road this year. That differential was greater than, I believe, any team in the league, but certainly of any playoff team in the league. The differential between their home record and their road record. The Pacers' home record was that of a top 4 team in the East. That's how good they are at home. And you're going to need every advantage when you're playing, you know, the defending champion. And with 3 All-Stars and Tristan Thompson, and oh yeah, they just bring like Darren Williams and Kyle Korver off the bench. You're going to need every advantage you can have against a team like this, and you know it's going to have to be like Eastern Conference Finals loud in there. And you know it's possible that in the first 6 minutes of the game, you know, Cleveland tries to take the crowd out of it and put all their energy into that, and perhaps the Cavs are up, you know, 6 to 8 points early. I think those are the moments when it's vital that the crowd stay in it and let the players feed off of that. So if you are coming to Bankers Life Fieldhouse on Thursday, bring the best version of you. That's key number 2.
I think that's a great one. That's when I looked at this series, I thought the Pacers could compete and make this a long series, because as I've said a time or two here and elsewhere, I go into every home game thinking the Pacers are going to win because of what I've seen, because of 29-12, and because of wins against teams like Oklahoma City and Houston and Cleveland, even in that game without LeBron James, and just so many times seeing them compete against the best of the best and having, you know, the ability to show they are an elite team at home, I think that they've got a real opportunity, and it has to happen in game three. The third pick three topic is something that, you know, we were texting back and forth during the game, just kind of waiting and hoping to see a little bit more out of Miles Turner in game two. And I thought heading into this series, he was someone that could potentially be a difference maker because of the matchup inside and because Cleveland is so much about their big three. And Tristan Thompson, for what he is outstanding at rebounding, he's not a scorer. And Miles Turner is someone who can be a scorer. But in the first two games of the series, I think he finished with 11-8 in game one, and he was 6-5 in game two. But for large stretches of game two, I just felt like he was out there, but he was not a part of the action really on either end. Now, he had some decent block shots, but it almost felt like defensively that was his whole game. And really, on either end, that's one thing. He was confident in his ability to block shots. He was waiting for those opportunities, and he had some decent block shots. But offensively, I just felt like he felt like he was almost in the way. And I don't know if that's a little bit of like Paul George being in such a zone where he did not need, you know, to go down low to Miles, or there just wasn't as much ball movement, and it didn't hurt the Pacers because of Paul George playing so well. But I just felt like Miles wasn't really in sync with his teammates. And then when he did get the ball, he hesitated. And he told me after the game that he just needs to slow down. He's been told that a time or two where he rushed his shots. I didn't personally think from watching that it was slowing down was the issue. I almost thought he was too hesitant at times. But like I said, and we just said a minute ago, we're just sideline guys. We're not coaches. But I just think his confidence, it's been up and down really for the last month and a half. And I know Mark Monteith and others have written about something with his finger maybe being an issue. I've never really seen him make an excuse about that. And we've seen some good shooting games in the last couple of weeks. I just think Miles needs to be a force right now on offense, and I don't think he's someone the Cavs are worried at all about through two games. And so he has to be a part of the action. He has to complement Paul George. They're going to continue to pressure and to double-team Paul the rest of this series. Shumpert, I think you'll see a lot more of Shumpert and not much of J.R. Smith, and if he wants to continue to pout about it, they might say, hey, we'll see you in the offseason, or, you know, if you don't like it, take your ball and go home, because he was pouting on the bench the entire time. So that's something to watch for. But with Shumpert, you're going to get someone who is focused entirely on pressure defense. And what their job and what their goal is going to be is to have Paul George get the ball out of his hands as quickly as possible. And if he gets the ball out of his hands, can he get it to Miles? And can he throw it to Miles and confidently think that Miles is going to finish? And I haven't been that confident when he caught the ball, especially in game two, and I think that needs to change. So he takes sometimes, as you know as well as anyone, he wears his emotions on his sleeves. After poor games, he takes probably more responsibility than he should. There are times this year where he accepted blame after a loss, and I've thought he has no reason to accept blame. He did it again last night. He didn't necessarily say the loss is my fault, but he admitted he needs to do better. And in this case, I'm on board with that sentiment. And I think he can. And I think he has so much room for growth. And I think he has such a bright future. But I think it's imperative for him to, you know, make some progress in game three.
All right. So that's our pick three, looking at keys moving forward in game three. And let's be honest, those are probably, we're going to be on that somewhat of that track for game number four as well. Game number three for Indiana is Thursday. It is at 7:00. And so is it going to be the same thing that fans have been getting used to here in the playoffs for you guys, Jeremiah?
Yes, we'll have Fox Sports Indiana Pacers live post-game coverage. It's a little bit different than in the road game coverage in that obviously it's at Bankers Life Fieldhouse, but Chris Denary, Quinn Buckner, and Eddie Gill will anchor the coverage from the Fox Loft, and I will be inside the locker room. So actually, I apologize for you, for someone who for 40 games has been the locker room interviewer. At this point, I'm going to take the microphone from you and do my best Pat Boylan impersonation. I'll probably have a little phone conversation, or I'll talk to you in person on Thursday to get some advice from managing my way in and around the locker room. But I am looking forward to being inside the home locker room, because let me tell you, the Cavs visiting locker room, when you combine a couple of cameras that have cables wired to them and you've got a couple of ice buckets in the middle of the floor, there's basically no room to operate. So we did the best we could to try to get some one-on-one interviews or to even try to get interviews at all. But it's very difficult on the road. Also, when you have disappointing, somewhat heartbreaking in game one losses, that's also challenging. So I wouldn't mind seeing a happy, spacious locker room after the game on Thursday, and hopefully we'll be on the air for an hour or so providing post-game coverage and possibly could even try to get a little Pat Boylan on the show if you'll be willing to talk to me after your radio duties are finished.
Of course. As always, you can turn over and catch Jeremiah Johnson, the guys on Fox Sports Indiana, after the game. Our radio coverage will be, as always, starting 30 minutes before and going about 90 minutes after with Eddie White and the World's Greatest Postgame Show. We'd love to have you there. Tickets, though, are very, very limited. I just went over to the site, and there's a handful left. So if you're thinking about doing this for Thursday, right now would be a good time to act on that. Pacers.com/tickets. It's a 7 o'clock tip on Thursday, and then on Sunday, these two games are guaranteed. Sunday, a 1 o'clock tip against the Cavs. The Kroger pregame show on the radio will begin at 12:30. We just broke down the keys. Any final thoughts here to game number 3? You're right, it's so pivotal, because you lose it and you fall down 3-0 to the defending champs. You win it, and all of a sudden you're looking at a home game 4 with the opportunity to erase what happened in Cleveland and put momentum on your side. Obviously, it's just one game, but this has the feel of way bigger than just one game, to me at least.
It's very important. And think about 82 games in the regular season. You think about all the work that goes in the training camp in the summer. And the guys that have 2 days to kind of get back and get down from, or I should say get up from the depth and the down that they feel after going down 0-2. And to kind of think about everything. And if you're a fan and you're someone who devotes a lot of your time to watching on television, listening on the radio, listening to podcasts, going to Bankers Life Fieldhouse, you do it for moments like this and games like this. And, you know, I said it at the end of the last podcast when you said, do you have any final thoughts? And I said, don't take this for granted, because the Pacers had the fight to get into the playoffs. Would they have liked to have been a higher seed than 7? Absolutely. Would they prefer to probably have played any of 6 other teams in the Eastern Conference in the first round than LeBron James? I don't know. I'm guessing probably, if everyone is being totally honest, it's the one team you wouldn't want to play in the first round. But that's who you have. And you know what? Paul George, LeBron James playoff games have been pretty memorable over the years. And I've had the privilege of seeing quite a few of them. Not all of them. I haven't been on the road for all of those Pacers Heat games, but I've seen quite a few of them. And the first two games of this series have lived up to the billing. Paul's played outstanding. The Pacers have had some good moments and they've had some bad moments. But it should be a great environment, a playoff intensity feel, because it is the playoffs, and it should be fun. So enjoy the buildup. Don't get all bent out of shape like I have been earlier today by some of the things people have said. And, you know, the sun's shining, it's spring, it's playoff basketball, it's Paul George, LeBron James. Really, it doesn't get much better than this. And if the Pacers can get this win, then the discussion and everything changes quite a bit prior to game 4.
Yeah, certainly. Again, game number 3, Thursday, April 20th, a 7 o'clock tip. You can catch Jeremiah and the Fox Sports Indiana crew right after. We will be talking to you at some point next week. We've not set out our schedule, and it depends on how games 3 and 4 go. Hope to be talking about a game 5 or a game 6 coming up in the future. But for now, we hope you enjoyed our analysis, especially on game 3 here coming up in the near future. Jeremiah, thanks.
All right, Pat, if the series shifts back to Cleveland for game 5, mark your calendars. I think we might have to plan on a Monday podcast to set up game 5. If not, it'd be a season ender at some point later on next week.
All right, that's Jeremiah Johnson. Hope to be talking to you on Monday, previewing game number 5. Thanks for listening to the Sideline Guys podcast.